Father John Erickson is Professor Emeritus of St. Vladimir's Seminary. He's a specialist in canon law and church history. I found out over a glass of wine. It wasn't Italian wine. We should have had Italian wine when we were talking about canon law. It was good wine. This afternoon, how that came about. He was Dean of St. Vladimir's from 2002 to 2007. He is, of course, about three-quarters Canadian, because he comes from Minnesota. He entered the Orthodox Church as a young man in 1964. But was ordained a priest very recently. I had not known that. It was so nice to know that, as a lay person, you had this long career at St. Vladimir's and did that work in that lovely body. Father John is the author of a number of books, The Orthodox Christians in America in 1999, The Quest for Unity, Orthodox and Roman Catholics in Dialogue with John Borelli in 1990. He's associate editor of Orthodox America and was a professor of church history for many years at St. Vladimir's. I was so touched in my personal conversations with him to hear that he stood beside my friend and a man who I consider one of my great teachers, Yaroslav Pelikan, when Pelikan entered the church. And that he also had the great privilege of bearing. So it's a lovely personal connection. And it makes it easy for me to forgive him for being Swedish. And wish him God's blessing. Thank you so much for coming. Lovely.
Thank you very much for your introduction. And I promise not to tell any Norwegian jokes. We had many in Minnesota when I was growing up. It's wonderful to be here in Edmonton. I've not been here. I've driven through Calgary on my driving across country once. I've been enjoying the city, and it's really wonderful to see snow again. We do have snow in Arizona up in the mountains, but this reminds me much more of growing up in northern Minnesota, which is what makes me, and my wife is from Minot, North Dakota, which is even closer to being Canadian. She even speaks practically like you folks. And I promise this is not, I'm not going to do all of this evening. This combines several other things. I'd like to begin with a deceptively simple question. What is the Orthodox Church? When we refer to this church, to our church, it's the church at least of most of us who are here this evening, what do we mean by this? If someone says, tell me about your church, how do we respond? How do we present this church to others? How do we present this church to ourselves? And this evening, and continuing on Saturday, I'd like to explore such questions by offering some reflections on Orthodox identity. I'll begin with some historical perspectives. And keep in mind, I taught church history for over 30 years, mostly ancient and medieval. But then I'd like to consider some challenges that we face in North America, in the United States and Canada, but also challenges in other lands of mass immigration in this, now the 21st century. As a point of departure, I'd like to consider the word identity itself. The word can be used in several ways. It comes from the Latin word idem, and as that suggests, in its proper sense, identity means self-sameness. It's what makes something to be one and the same yesterday, today, and forever. But in everyday English, the word identity is also used in a looser sense to mean individuality. What distinguishes one thing from others? I'm quoting now from a dictionary definition, the set of behavioral or individual characteristics by which a thing is definitively recognizable or known. So in the United States at least, and maybe here in Canada also, one can speak of an underworld informant being given a new identity as part of a government witness protection program. When referring to the church, theologians, Orthodox theologians, most often use the word identity in the former sense of the word, to mean self-sameness. Consider this passage from an essay by Father George Florovsky, who's one of the most distinguished Orthodox theologians of the 20th century, and I'm sure many of you have read essays by him and books. The Orthodox Church, he says, claims to be the Church. The Orthodox Church is conscious and aware of her identity through the ages, in spite of all perplexities and changes. She has kept intact and immaculate the sacred heritage of the early Church, of the apostles and the fathers, the faith which was once delivered to the saints. She is aware of the identity of her teaching with the apostolic message and the tradition of the ancient Church, even though she might have failed occasionally to convey this message to particular generations in its full splendor and in a way that carries conviction. What gives the Orthodox Church her identity, Florovsky continues, is living tradition. He observes this is not just a human tradition maintained by human memory and imitation. Rather, it is a sacred or holy tradition maintained by the abiding presence and guidance of the Holy Spirit. The ultimate identity of the Church is grounded in her sacramental structure, in the organic continuity of the body. And again, I take this simply as typical of the way in which many people would write and speak of the Church and the identity of the Church. I think most Orthodox theologians would accept this understanding of the identity of the Orthodox Church. Like Florovsky, they would locate the ultimate identity of the Church in her sacramental structure, in her organic, in the organic continuity of the body, in the sacramental and spiritual life, which has been, again quoting Florovsky, which has been ever the same in the course of ages, despite historic failures and losses, despite perplexities and changes, despite the fact, Florovsky says in another lecture, and I think very truly, despite the fact that the true Church is not yet the perfect Church. I mention all this because seen through the eyes of faith, the ultimate identity of the Orthodox Church as the Spirit-filled body of Christ is evident. But what is evident to the eyes of faith may be less evident to outside observers, may be less evident to outside observers, and in this category we have to count not just sociologists, historians, other students of empirical phenomena, but Orthodox Christians themselves. Our perception of the Orthodox Church has been molded by those historic failures and losses, those perplexities and changes that Florovsky speaks of, perhaps more than Florovsky and many theologians have been willing to recognize. The externally perceptible identity of the Orthodox Church, that set of behavioral or individual characteristics by which an observer might identify and recognize the Orthodox Church, is more complex more difficult to explain than theologians sometimes acknowledge. Just consider trying to give a succinct definition of the Orthodox Church. Let's say you're writing a newspaper article, or for the more academically inclined, a dictionary entry. A presentation that limited itself to the kinds of theological truths I was just repeating would lack credibility. Even a sympathetic reader might have difficulty recognizing in it the historic Orthodox Church that we encounter in everyday life, that we encounter in everyday life here in Alberta or in Arizona, through whatever province or state begins with a Z. Let me just offer as an illustration. One of the churches, I serve pretty regularly and pretty evenly in four churches in southern Arizona, one in the Serbian Western Diocese, one in the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese, one in the Antiochian Archdiocese, and one in the OCA. Four different churches, four jurisdictions, two calendars, lots of differences, and four bishops. Let me use just as an example, though, St. Demetrius Greek Orthodox Church in Tucson, Arizona. We're very proud at St. Demetrius to have the largest Greek festival in the state of Arizona. It runs for 4 days, packs in enormous crowds. There can be lines up to 40 minutes just waiting to pay the admissions to get into it. It's a wonderful event. It pays the assessment for the parish, the diocese, many other things. It also has a very active Philopticus Society, the women's organization. The people who are most active in it are the American wives of a number of the Greek male parishioners. They may not go very often, but the wives are there, and they make very wonderful baklava. St. Demetrius also has a celebrated troupe of Panathenian dancers, young people. Their numbers include two Eritrean kids, because it is a very diverse parish. In fact, this is the Orthodox Church as we meet it on Fort Lowell Road in Tucson, Arizona. I'm sure you can find diversity of this sort, surprises of this sort in Alberta as well. So let's turn now to this externally perceptible identity of the Orthodox Church, the way we appear to others. As this is presented first in popular introductions to Orthodoxy, here I'm going to be putting together a string of passages from Metropolitan Callistos Ware's The Orthodox Church, probably the most popular introduction to Orthodoxy going, and probably most of you have looked at it from time to time. He described the Orthodox Church most often described as a family of self-governing churches which are held together not by a single prelate wielding absolute power over the whole body, but by the double bond of unity in faith and communion in the sacraments. Then he continues, so far, theological verities. In popular presentations of this sort, the universal vocation of Orthodoxy may be acknowledged, but certainly the self-governing churches actually constituting this family are more or less accurately recognized as being Eastern, as distinct from Western in their primary geographic distribution, as being Greek, as distinct from Latin or Syriac in their theological tradition, largely ethnic, Russian, Romanian, Ukrainian, Bulgarian, Greek in their culture. The special role of the Patriarch of Constantinople in this family, often a dysfunctional family of churches, may be mentioned, but usually it's in a way to contrast his position with that of the Pope in the Roman Catholic Church. As further refinements and qualifications are added, these popular presentations do give a reasonably accurate account of the set of behavioral or individual characteristics by which an outsider might recognize and identify the Orthodox Church. As they do so, they suggest also how difficult it can be to recognize the externally perceptible identity of the Orthodox Church, how we look to others and even to ourselves, with that self-sameness that we experience in the Church's sacramental and spiritual life. How do you hold these together? Also, these externally perceptible aspects of our identity suggest the high degree to which Orthodox identity in its external aspect has been formed in very particular historical circumstances. These circumstances, some economic, political, circumstances of the sort typically studied by historians, but there's also a specifically religious element involved in the way in which we come to be viewed. To a high degree, and I'll spend a couple minutes on this theme, to a high degree, Orthodox identity in its external aspect has been formed in the context of Christian divisions. The characteristics by which not only outsiders, but we ourselves identify our church most often are those that make us different from other Christian groups. Certainly that has been, over the centuries, how we have gone about presenting ourselves or others have identified us. Now, a full account of how these distinctive characteristics have emerged and have gained prominence in Orthodox self-understanding, this would require many volumes. I usually do that in two semesters, or three, depending on changes in the curriculum. At the risk of oversimplification, we can identify two ways this has happened. This has happened by emulation, that is, by imitation or appropriation for oneself of claims, institutions, or practices of another. Or it can take place by way of contradiction, that is, by rejection of the claims, institutions, or practices of another, and the concurrent development of claims, institutions, or practices more or less directly opposed to them. This may sound awfully abstract, but I'll offer an example. I'll offer an example from ancient church history, one that will not be particularly controversial at this point. Let me illustrate with reference to the history of relations between Eastern Orthodox, Chalcedonian, Byzantine tradition Orthodox, us, in other words, our relations with the non-Chalcedonian or Oriental Orthodox, once upon a time very often incorrectly referred to as Monophysite. The division between our families of churches goes back to the Council of Chalcedon in the year 451 AD. We call this the Fourth Ecumenical Council. They don't. In this Oriental Orthodox, pre-Chalcedonian or non-Chalcedonian family of churches would be the Copts, whom we will be visiting in the course of these events. David, you'll have to remind me when it is that we're doing this. Copts in Egypt, Armenians, Syrians, Ethiopians, Eritreans in their home countries. In the decades immediately following the Council of Chalcedon, back in the 5th century, both sides competed for the designation Orthodox. In various ways, they tried to demonstrate their own perfect fidelity to the faith of Nicaea, the first ecumenical council. For example, it was in this context that the Creed, the Nicene Creed, was introduced into the Divine Liturgy. The Creed hadn't been used in the course of the Divine Liturgy until that point. It was associated with baptism. But it's at this point that you prove that you're really Orthodox by saying the Nicene Creed at every liturgy. But somewhat later, emulation of this sort gives way to contradiction. We can see this at its simplest in our Triodion rubric for Cheese Fair Week. During this week, the accursed Armenians fast from eggs and cheese, but we, to refute their damnable heresy, do eat both eggs and cheese for the entire week. In other words, what one side does is enough to prompt the other to do the opposite. Also, in this same period, new and divergent symbolic interpretations come to be given to ancient liturgical practices that originally had nothing divisive about them at all, no polemical intent at all. For example, the use of leavened or unleavened bread in the Eucharist, the use of a mingled chalice with water, warm water added as we do, or not. All of these things eventually are given a polemical understanding, although they originally arose without any polemical intent at all. I mentioned these elements of emulation and contradiction, our relation with the Oriental Orthodox. At this point, it's no longer a significant problem, but this same process can be seen in our relations with the Latin West from the later Middle Ages onward. Certainly, scholars now recognize the separation of the churches can't be dated with precision. Don't exaggerate the importance of the year 1054, people say. This is the year of the schism, and sometimes you get branching, you know, sort of schema showing how churches branched off one way or another. Only very slowly did their alienation reach a point that these churches regarded the other as being outside the fullness of the church. Long after 1054, when churchmen in the Byzantine East contested Rome's claim to be the universal mother church, they did so by appealing to the idea of the pentarchy of patriarchies, meaning here Rome first, then Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem. All this recalling the idea of the church, the ancient Christian understanding of the church as an ordered communion of sister churches. But from the 13th century onward, we can notice signs of change as Roman claims begin to have serious implications. I think, for example, of Frankish Western Crusaders sacking Constantinople in the year 1204, something still very painful in people's memory. Hitherto, the Easterners, and this is getting too much into Byzantine history probably, hitherto Easterners had taken the existence and the external support of the Byzantine Empire, Roman Empire, for granted. Now the empire is crumbling. In the vacuum, patriarchs of Constantinople, initially living in exile in Nicaea, began to rebut papal claims to universal authority by calling attention to their own universal authority among the right believing, among us, rather than the emperor, or a fortiori, the pope. Now the patriarch comes to be seen as the focal point of the civilized world, the symbol of the unity, the identity of an organic Orthodox Christian world now over against the Latin West. Again, I'm sketching this as quickly as possible. You can see how developments in one area will influence the way that we present ourselves. In other words, Latin claims are rejected, but aspects of these claims are adopted as our own. After the fall of Constantinople to the Turks, signs of emulation, contradiction, often in combination, multiply. The most often cited examples, some of you will be familiar with this, are in the area of theology, a kind of uncritical adoption of Latin scholastic categories. Most often this is blamed on Peter Mohila, canonized in two jurisdictions, or three, roundly castigated in another. Florovsky referred to this as a pseudomorphosis of Orthodox theology. It was conspicuous in Ukraine and Russia. But this same tendency can be detected elsewhere, even when anti-Latin feeling is very, very strong. For example, in the Greek East in the 18th century, there was a big controversy about confession. Many of you may be familiar with the name of St. Nicodemus the Augurite, St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain. He is the perennial favorite of Orthodox traditionalists, very often, you know, people look to him as an example of true Orthodoxy against anything Latin. Now, this again may get a little technical sounding. He wrote a manual for confessors, How to Hear Confessions. In this manual, St. Nicodemus insists on the use of a deprecative formula of absolution, may God forgive. And he vigorously attacks use of an indicative formula, I forgive and absolve. A patriarch of Constantinople, Callinicus III, had insisted that was the right formula to use, confession. Now, it's easy to say how right St. Nicodemus was. This indicative formula, I an unworthy priest, forgive and absolve. This certainly, we say, must be a sign of Latinization. But there's a lot of irony in this. Because like his opponent, Patriarch Callinicus, St. Nicodemus the Augurite was preoccupied with determining the right formula to use. In earlier centuries, there was not a preoccupation with this at all. There was a whole range of things, formulas, or rather words and prayers that would be said. Not an effort to find a single right formula for absolution. And this is a preoccupation you don't find earlier, and St. Nicodemus refers to his preferred words precisely as the form of the sacrament, in Greek, to eidos tou mysteriou. This is technical, theological vocabulary, and it is straight out of Latin scholastic theological vocabulary, the form of the sacrament. He attacks the indicative formula as a Latinization, but he does so, St. Nicodemus does so, in the context, in the framework of a sacramental theology that itself is quite Latinized, even in its technical terminology. Again, there are a lot of ironies of this sort. Less often noted is the impact that developments in Latin understanding of the church had on our Orthodox self-definition in this period. The Latin church, the Western church in the Middle Ages, could be described as a big tent. All kinds of theological currents and views of church polity could be encountered. This changes in the age of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. The Reformers tended to view the church as the invisible body of true believers. Again, I'm oversimplifying. That is to say, those who had correctly perceived the, appreciated the doctrine of salvation by faith alone. Against this invisible understanding of the church, Roman Catholic theologians developed what has been called soteriological and ecclesiological exclusivism. That is, the idea that no salvation is possible outside the visible institutional structures of the Roman Catholic Church. Quickly enough, this understanding of the Church, initially developed against the Protestants, comes to be applied to the Orthodox as well. An earlier sacramental approach could suggest that the Orthodox, an approach common both East and West, could envision reunion as restoration of communion between sister churches, estranged churches, but could envision reconciliation. Now this gives way in the Catholic West to a predominantly institutional ecclesiology aimed at conversion of individual schismatics to the Roman Church and their submission to the Roman Pontiff, his very visible head. This new ecclesiology expressed itself in a number of ways, for example, with the development, with the establishment of now called Eastern Catholic churches, which tended to drive the churches even farther apart rather than bring them closer together. Symptomatic, more than ever, each side came to insist on itself as being the exclusive bearer of salvation. Symptomatic on the Roman Catholic side was a 1729 order of the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, which was in charge of Eastern churches at that time, forbid any communicatio in sacris with the dissident Orientals, meaning us. Communicatio in sacris, communion in sacred things, did not mean simply receiving communion. People didn't receive communion very often anyway. It meant going into churches, venerating images, genuflecting in the course of processions, the kinds of so forth. You could not go to a funeral or anything in somebody else in the other guy's church. That on the Catholic side. Symptomatic on the Orthodox side is, I'm giving the official title, Definition of the Holy Great Church of Christ, defending the holy baptism given from God and spitting upon the baptisms of the heretics. This was issued by Patriarch Cyril V of Constantinople in 1755. It's a pronouncement, by the way, that has never been officially rescinded, though it's been enforced only erratically. In other words, just as for the Roman Catholics, the dissident Orientals, we were completely outside, so also for the Orthodox. The Latins were completely outside. So completely outside that they were to be regarded as unbaptized. And if on occasion an exception was made, and if they were received without being rebaptized, this was considered simply a matter of economy, signifying nothing of spiritual about the spiritual state of or ecclesial status of the groups in question. This line of thinking is, in fact, one can still encounter quite frequently these days, although it is really basically an 18th century invention. This was the state of Orthodox Catholic relations in the 18th century. In the 19th century, Orthodox controversial apologetical literature elaborated on some of these themes, developed several new ones. For example, Orthodox apologetical literature would stress the conciliar character of Orthodoxy, this in contrast to the absolute monarchical character of Catholicism. Orthodoxy's decentralization and identification with national cultures was contrasted with Roman emphasis on uniformity and the exclusive use of Latin, and so on. In short, through emulation and contradiction, Orthodox identity in its external aspect continued to develop in counterpoint with Roman Catholicism and to a lesser degree with Protestantism. The usual joke is told that Orthodox used Protestant arguments to refute the Catholics and Catholic arguments to refute the Protestants. And again, this brings us to a very basic question and one that has, I'll spare you more ancient history, but brings us back to a very basic question. What is the relationship between the ultimate identity of the Orthodox Church as the Spirit-filled body of Christ and her externally perceived identity? This identity formed through emulation and contradiction in the midst of all those historic failures and losses, those perplexities and contradictions, those that Florovsky alluded to, I mentioned a few moments ago. For much of the Church's history, this question wouldn't have troubled most Orthodox Christians, whether hierarchs or theologians or ordinary churchgoers. They took for granted the full consonance, the complete agreement of all aspects of the Church's identity, not just its underlying belief structures, but all its distinctive practices and customs. And their adherence to the Church was reinforced by a number of societal supports. Sometimes, as in Byzantium, as in the Russian Empire, Orthodox Christians were in a dominant or hegemonic position. At other times, as in the Ottoman Empire, the Orthodox formed a close-knit subject population, marginalized within the dominant society and culture. Still other times, in, I would say, classic diaspora situations, they constituted a permanent foreign colony in the midst of the host culture. A wonderful example in Potsdam, near Berlin. There's a charming collection of Russian-style houses in a beautiful Russian Orthodox church, the early 19th century. They were built in the early 19th century under the patronage of King Friedrich Wilhelm III of Prussia to accommodate the chorus of Russian singers that he hired to entertain his first Prussian regiment of the guard. Still there, lovely, lovely place. But again, clearly a foreign colony in the midst of a host culture. Very different from our situation here in Canada, for example. In all these situations from the past, whether in a hegemonic position or marginalized in a ghetto situation or as a little colony in a host culture, Orthodox identity could be taken for granted as something into which you were born and from which you could not escape save by renouncing it in favor of a new and totally different identity, and this was usually by converting to another religion. Catholicism or to Islam or what have you. In over the past century, this complacency has been shaken in various ways. Nowhere has that been truer than in countries formed by massive immigration. My own case, the United States, certainly. Canada, Australia, some of the countries of Latin America, have been totally refashioned and formed by mass immigration. And first of all, our societies at this point are notably and proudly pluralistic. One just has to look up articles on Canada, and that will be signaled as one of the main characteristics, even to the point now there's some questioning of the limits of pluralism. In the United States, we've moved from a state church system to an unofficial Protestant establishment to a nation of Protestant Catholic Jew, the title of a famous essay by Will Herbert, to a nation now in which virtually every religious and special interest group known to humankind has a chance to be heard and to thrive. Canada's religious trajectory has been a little different, but only a little different. I did some homework, a factoid that maybe even you Canadians don't know. When was the first census undertaken in the Dominion of Canada? 1871, shortly after the formation of the Dominion. At the time, in this first census, 98% of the population indicated they were Christian, of whom 43% were Catholic, concentrated in Quebec, French-speaking Quebec. 52% were mainline British background Protestants, Anglican, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist. That was it. But with massive immigration in the closing decades of the 19th century onward, the religious and ethnic makeup of Canada changed dramatically. For example, by 1911, again, I do a little homework for these things, there were nearly 90,000 Ukrainians of Eastern Christian tradition, mostly in the prairie provinces here. And certainly many more since then. Certainly also large numbers of Mormons, Mennonites, Hutterites, and so on. Ethnic, racial, and consequently also religious diversity were somewhat constrained, partly by depression where nobody went anyplace, and also partly constrained by preferential immigration policies for a time, favored European, favored, in fact, British and French, and then United States in terms of preferences. But with the Immigration Act of 1976, any remnants of this has changed. And so in Canada, just as in the United States, people come from everywhere and from every kind of background imaginable. I'm sure you're going to lecture me eventually on the differences between the United States and Canada. We could do that another time. In our North American context, whether the United States or Canada, pluralism doesn't mean simply that a number of religious groups coexist on the same territory. If that were the definition of pluralism, even the Ottoman Empire would qualify. It means that these religious groups are free to compete for souls, or to engage in dialogue, or to cooperate in any number of common projects, or to remain aloof from any contact whatsoever, just so long as they maintain a modicum of civility and eschew violence. Pluralism, in this context, also means that a person's religious identity can't be taken for granted as something you acquire at birth, as once may have been the case in both our countries. Rather, it involves an element of intention, an element of decision, indeed of ongoing decision. All religious groups in our countries are forced to deal with sociologist Peter Berger called an uncoerced clientele, a clientele free to choose their own religious identity, or what is very common today, free to fashion their own religious identity by putting together a personalized patchwork religion. If any of you have had a child say to you, "I think I'm a Buddhist," don't take that as an occasion for confrontation. It's simply an invitation for conversation. And it's the kind of conversation that I think many people, whether in the United States or Canada, have. Now, this experience of pluralism, it's affected all religious groups in North America and other lands of massive immigration, but not always in the same way. In my estimation, Orthodox Christians have had a particularly hard time adjusting. In our collective historical memory, from our collective historical memory, we are equipped to deal with a variety of situations, ranging from hegemony to ghettoization, persecution and sectarian strife. But our historical memory hasn't equipped us to deal with religious pluralism, the sort that we have in the United States and Canada. It's relatively easy to trace the formation of Orthodox ecclesial identity over many centuries. I gave you a very condensed version earlier. It's much harder to trace the formation of a specifically American or Canadian or Australian Orthodox ecclesial identity. Almost inevitably, one would be forced to speak not of identity, but of identities. In the late 1990s, I was asked to write a popular history of Orthodox Christians in North America. In principle, this was to include Canada and Mexico, as well as the United States, and to cover the Oriental Orthodox as well as the Eastern Orthodox, all this in very short scope. I immediately wondered whether such a history was possible. Was there enough unity of subject to permit such a history? It's not just that you have a lot of material. It's just that how does this make a story? Just consider the way in which Orthodox Christians themselves have recounted their history in the New World. I have in mind a 1984 collective work. It's entitled A Companion to the Greek Orthodox Church, an excellent little volume as far as it goes. It includes, in appendix, a list of milestones in the history of Orthodoxy in America. The first entry reads, 1528, George the Griego arrived in Florida, the first known Greek to come to America. Now, we, of course, know nothing whatsoever about George the Griego's religious beliefs and affiliation, if any. Under the circumstances, coming when he did to what was then a Spanish outpost, it's unlikely that he was a practicing Orthodox Christian, or that his arrival left any lasting Orthodox imprint on this continent. I mention this because comparable examples can be found in other jurisdictional history. The history of Orthodoxy in the United States, the history of Orthodoxy in Canada or Australia or other lands of massive immigration comes to be little more than a collection of ethnographies. You have a book on Ukrainians in Canada or Ukrainians in Alberta, and there will be a chapter devoted to the religious factor. Or History of Greeks, a fine volume by Ted Salutos on Greeks in America, two chapters on the church. So also History of Serbs have a chapter on religion. But a history of Orthodoxy in America, very hard to find. Individual Orthodox Christians face similar problems. Someone asks, what are you, in the context, assuming that you're going to be responding on in terms of religious identification. Very seldom is it enough simply to say Orthodox. I lived for a very long time in New York, and that would have had a very different meaning in New York. It would have meant that I was Jewish. It's not enough even to say Orthodox Christian in many cases. Inevitably, you're pressed to add a modifier, usually relating to ethnicity. Greek, Russian, Ukrainian, Serbian. The very least, one is pressed to acknowledge being Eastern. In the United States, at least, even among the Orthodox themselves, Orthodoxy is perceived as something foreign, exotic, so closely linked to alien cultures as to be non-American, if not altogether un-American, because there have been periods when we've been regarded as un-American and subversive. But even to our fellow Orthodox Christians, this claim can, some people will say, insist, that they are simply Orthodox. But even to many of our fellow Orthodox, this claim seems presumptuous, a contradiction in terms, a claim to an impossible identity. How can you really be Orthodox, be American, Canadian? Much here depends on what it means to be Orthodox and what it means to be Canadian or American, what it means to uphold Canadian values or American values. So much of Canadian history and also U.S. history was spent in trying to form people in accordance with Canadian values and get them to adopt Canadian values or American values. And in the process, forgetting some of their tribal old world ways. In any case, neither the term Orthodox nor the term American or Canadian is self-evident. These don't represent stable, static realities. The definition of Orthodox has changed in various ways over many centuries. So also the definition of what it means to be an American, what it means to be a Canadian. Over the centuries, over the decades, definitions of Canadian or American have become ever broader, ever more capacious, as our national experiments with pluralism have expanded. At the same time, the definition of Orthodox, I fear sometimes, has become ever more fragmented. Now, of course, the most obvious factor complicating Orthodox identity, whether in the United States or Canada, has been ethnicity. Sometimes, a sense of ethnic identity is stronger than a sense of Orthodox religious identity. This is hardly a new discovery on my part. There are many reasons for this. Very often, and quite understandably, Orthodox Christians have found it difficult to imagine an Orthodox identity without a corresponding cultural or ethnic identity. But given the dynamics of religion in our nations, as these have been presented by sociologists and by general church historians, one would have expected the ethnic factor gradually to recede in importance, to lose its power to divide. That, at least, is what Orthodox Christians growing up in the United States in the decades following World War II were led to expect. I believe this is also what Orthodox Christians in Canada were led to expect in the course of the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. The expectation was that Orthodox Christians, that in lands of immigration, the United States, Canada, there would be gradual integration into the mainstream of American life, into the mainstream of Canadian life. In the United States, we went from being immigrants to being hyphenated Americans, Greek Americans, Russian Americans, Ukrainian Americans, and so on, to being Americans whose religious preference was Eastern Orthodox. This in the 50s and 60s, continuing in the 70s. And that was how church history textbooks were written as well. Gradual integration of immigrant groups, religious groups, into mainstream life. This was what was going on in the 1960s, and I'm sure many of you can remember those days as well as I can, probably better than I can. I get forgetful in my old age. I was referring a moment ago to those milestones in the history of Orthodoxy in America. There are comparable presentations that could be mentioned. We began with small, isolated beginnings, pioneers like George the Griego. Then waves of immigrants establish ethnic parishes. Gradually, the ethnic jurisdiction emerges, giving an element of institutional stability to the religio-ethnic groups in question. And most of these jurisdictions formed in the interwar period, or included both the United States and Canada, or even more. For example, the Greek there was the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of North and South America. Very comprehensive. The Serbian Orthodox Church in North and South America. The Romanian Orthodox Episcopate of America also covered both the United States and Canada. The main exception here would have been the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in the USA, distinct from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Canada. But over a dozen such jurisdictions in the 1940s. But following World War II, we become more and more integrated, you think. In the United States, we had in this period 1955 official congressional recognition as a major faith. Again, I'm going from these milestones of Orthodoxy in America. 1957, Archbishop Michael of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese becomes the first Orthodox hierarch to take part in a presidential election. 1967, Archbishop Yakovos walks with Martin Luther King Jr. and other religious leaders in the March on Selma, Alabama. Similar milestones could be mentioned, noted in Canada. 1989. What happened in 1989? What? Natition was named Governor General. There similar integration into society. In the United States, at least, Orthodox were joining Protestants, Catholics, and Jews as full-fledged Americans. The nation's pluralism, by that point, having expanded to accommodate what lingering elements of symbolic identity these immigrants and descendants of immigrants might have. So you continue to eat pierogi, baklava, and have Panathenian dance troops, but you no longer speak Greek or Serbian or any number of other things that are a little bit harder to master than baklava recipes. So as we were becoming more American, the Orthodox were also beginning to come together in greater unity. Their common American Orthodox identity was beginning to transcend ethnic particularities. Here we can note another milestone that affected both the United States and Canada, since the jurisdictions spanned the border at that point. 1960, the formation of SCOBA, the Standing Conference of Canonical Orthodox Bishops in America, body that brought together heads of nearly all the Orthodox jurisdictions in North America. It seemed to anticipate a united Orthodox Church in America, and the establishment, this being simply a manifestation of a common Orthodox identity. This is how the story of Orthodoxy in America seemed to be going when that companion to the Greek Orthodox Church was being assembled, when I was in high school and college and university. This is how many Orthodox Christians in America expected the story to go. This is how the story was supposed to go. Even the sociologists said this was inevitable. But over the last few decades, the story of Orthodoxy in the United States, and I believe also in Canada, has taken a very different turn. In my estimation, anyway, Orthodox Christians in North America are less united now than they were in the 1960s and 70s. Why? This is not simply because of personalities, though this has to be taken into consideration. People like Archbishop Yakovos, he was a giant. This is not simply because of ethnic resilience reinforced by new immigration, though this has been massive both in the United States and in Canada. first in the wake of the Cyprus crisis, then civil war in Lebanon, then the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. It's transformed our parishes. Parishes that were once mostly English-speaking, Greek-American parishes, for example, were mostly English-speaking, then became, again, Greek-speaking principally. And so also other ethnic groups the same way. Our parishes, I would say we are less homogeneous than we were 40 or 50 years ago. 40 or 50 years ago, we were all basically hyphenated Americans or hyphenated Canadians. Ukrainian Canadian, Greek Canadian, Russian Canadian, what have you. Now, this is changing. This change also isn't simply because of changing global politics. Improved communications, cheap airfares, all of which have facilitated closer contact between mother churches in the old world and their dependencies in the new. And also, I would add here, more influence and more control over new world dependencies. I'd like to present an argument here. Our present disunity, our seeming lack of a common Orthodox identity in North America may be the result of some underlying disagreements about what constitutes Orthodox identity itself. These disagreements, I would suggest, have developed and increased as literate and well-meaning Orthodox Christians in North America, that uncoerced clientele that sociologist Peter Berger speaks of, have discovered and have freely and self-consciously adopted for themselves some very different and disparate Orthodox identities. Most often as the result of extensive, though perhaps selective, readings in Orthodox theology. Books on Orthodoxy in English have proliferated, as we all know, and in French for that matter. So also have internet resources. Many of these books may not be worth reading, but read they are. Even those that are well worth reading may be read and understood and applied in very different ways. Some of my teachers long ago, and colleagues in a couple cases, were theologians, Father George Florovsky I've mentioned before, Father Alexander Schmemann, Father John Meyendorf. They were emigres. They were very important, though, in bringing Orthodox theology to America and presenting America to the Orthodox world. And here I would include Canada. Meyendorf's and Schmemann's spent all their summers at Lac La Belle in the Laurentides. So at least they were at least a quarter Canadian in residence. These people, on the one hand, theologians, contributed to the Orthodoxy's adjustment and adaptation in the North American context. They were involved in the ecumenical movement in various ways, putting Orthodoxy into a more conspicuous position on the world stage. They were experts in early church history and thought. They found in the fathers of the church and in the worship of the early church resources for the strengthening and renewal of church life today. They called on Orthodox Christians in North America to rediscover their common trans-ethnic, supracultural identity. They denounced what Father Schmemann called the evil plague of jurisdictionalism. They called for Orthodox unity. They drew attention to the importance of mission in the history of Orthodoxy, including the history of Orthodoxy in America, as witnessed in the name of this church itself. They emphasized the importance of the church's worship, above all, the Eucharist, for all aspects of the church's life, implemented on a parish level. This meant, among other things, greater use of living vernacular languages, English and French, in church services, more frequent communion. You know many of the things that you're familiar with here in this parish. So, theologians, Orthodox theology, they're books. have contributed to the integration of Orthodoxy in North American life, but the story isn't quite so simple, though it is drawing to a close, I assure you. The works, even of the people that I've just mentioned, people like Florovsky, Mayendorf, Schmemann, could be read in very different ways and have been read in very different ways. Among other things, these theologians had a deep interest in the problem of the relationship between Christianity and culture. At the risk of gross oversimplification, their contribution can be summed up by using categories that those of you familiar with H. Richard Niebuhr's classic work, Christ and Culture, will be aware of, sort of a classic in religious studies, in reaction to an orthodoxy that regarded itself as the bearer of culture, but in fact was submerged in culture and effectively reduced to ethnic culture. These emigre theologians preached a message of Christ, the transformer of culture. Just as the Christian message once transformed and transfigured Hellenistic culture, just as the Orthodox message transformed and transfigured other cultures, Slavic, Native American, what have you, so now also, they argued, the Orthodox Christian message must transform and transfigure North American culture. This is one way you could read Orthodox theology today and its contribution. But often Orthodox theology and the contribution of theologians to this, in their books to this, can be read in a slightly different way. It can be read as a message of Orthodox, of Christ over culture. Or rather, it has been read as a message of Orthodox Christianity and culture over Western culture. The West, according to this line of thinking, has been poisoned by rationalism, legalism, secularism. The East, by contrast, has maintained the authentic Christian vision of God and the world, above all in its experience of worship, and this despite the baneful Western influences on its institutions, on its formal presentations of theology, and so on. You can see two very different interpretations of orthodoxy in its relation to culture, orthodoxy in its relation to our North American situation. And I would say that the impact of books, books of the people I've mentioned and many other things that people read, the ways that we have discovered orthodoxy, the way that so many of us have read our way into orthodoxy, this can be unsettling. The impact has been enlivening, brings you here tonight, but also unsettling, and it's also cut across old jurisdictional lines to reveal the multifaceted character of orthodoxy itself. It takes only a quick browsing of the internet to demonstrate this. In the United States, at least, and I expect also in Canada, there are a host of controversies troubling Orthodox Church life today, down to the parish level. Controversies about forms and styles of leadership. Controversies about accountability and transparency. Controversies about liturgical practice and even musical idiom. Controversies about the place of monastic expressions of piety in parish contexts. And the list could go on and on. I expect you've run into controversies of this sort. A significant but easily overlooked truth about orthodoxy helps explain why this has been the case. Orthodox Christians live by an ideal, whether they are able to articulate this ideal or not. Orthodox Christians sense the need for wholeness, for integralness, I guess one could say, for authentic church life to penetrate the surrounding culture. And over the centuries, Orthodox Christians have had some experience of this integralness in our various old world Orthodox Christian empires and nations, even when these have been reduced to a ghettoized situation. And Orthodox Christians, in turn, believe that the greatest threat to Orthodoxy in North America and elsewhere in the so-called diaspora, much discussed topic, comes from dilution, comes from loss of authenticity, loss of wholeness, loss of integralness. And this fear holds true not just for cradle Orthodox Christians. I think they are, in fact, relatively unconcerned about this. It holds true also for converts to Orthodoxy and reverts to Orthodoxy. People who were raised and baptized in the Orthodox Church spent a great deal of life away from the Orthodox Church and then reverted to Orthodoxy at a later point. North Americans of whatever sort have found Orthodoxy attractive in large part because Orthodoxy has been a culture informing Christianity, a Christianity not content with remaining on the margins of life even under difficult circumstances, so that church goes on not just here, but in our homes, in the way we arrange our homes, the way that we pray and when we pray, so many aspects of life touched. I remember my children, we were fixing hot dogs at the beach once, and I didn't say a prayer. And their conclusion was, we don't bless hot dogs. You know, so habituated they were to the idea that you do things in a certain ritual way. And it's not just confined to doing it here. It's also something that you even do at the beach. I would say that Orthodox Christians have found people coming to Orthodoxy, rediscovering Orthodoxy or experiencing it, find it attractive precisely because it doesn't separate a timeless essence of Christianity from its historical manifestations, because it bridges the gap between the ultimate identity and the perceived identity of the church, because it holds together classic expressions of mystical theology, Vladimir Lossky's mystical theology of the Orthodox Church or the Philokalia or what have you, with the Panathenian dancers at St. Demetrius Greek Orthodox Church in Tucson. In the past, in the heyday of the ethnic jurisdiction, this preoccupation with integralness most often was expressed in the form of ethnicism, and this is still sometimes the case today. But today, Orthodox preoccupation with authenticity, with wholeness, with integralness, can't be explained simply as vestigial ethnicism. Today, some people would argue that authentic Orthodoxy calls for greater openness to the surrounding culture, if enculturation on the Alaskan mission model is to take place in North America, if we're really going to transform this world in which we live. But today also an increasingly vocal minority argues that authentic Orthodoxy calls for maintenance of a style of life and practice that visibly distinguishes and separates Orthodox Christians from the surrounding culture. There is, however, no longer a direct correlation between such positions and ethnic background or jurisdictional affiliation. You find the same cleavages in every jurisdiction that I know in North America. If anything, the increasingly derided modernist is more likely to be cradle Orthodox than convert. And if anything, the self-styled traditionalist is more likely to be an American convert who has read his way into Orthodoxy, or a cradle Orthodox revert who has read his way back into Orthodoxy, than a cradle Orthodox who has remained in church life all his life or all her life. Those of you who from time to time look at Facebook or elsewhere, you may be familiar with a meme, Herman Hyperdox. You run across this, any of you? Some of you, not very many. Anyway, it's a meme. It shows a bearded younger guy with self-satisfied and self-righteous expression on his face, and the text ever changing with this. For example, one of them, still a catechumen and has already switched jurisdictions 3 times. Has to give a presentation at work. Begins by saying, "Wisdom, let us attend." Or parents wouldn't call him Barsanuphius at the family reunion. Reminds self that Jesus said his disciples would be persecuted. You get the idea. At this point in North America, we're faced with a plethora of views as to what constitutes authentic orthodoxy, integral orthodoxy. What should be our orthodox identity in this new world context? At least in the United States, very possibly here in Canada also, even within a single jurisdiction, one can find, depending on bishop or parish or priest or faction, an ethnic reduction, a hyphenated American reduction, a conservative evangelical reduction, a traditionalist reduction, and possibly other reductions of orthodoxy. Reductions that would seize upon select aspects of our externally perceived identity as being the quintessence of the faith. More versions of orthodox identity, no doubt, could be mentioned. Talk more about that maybe another night. The problem facing us is this. How can we properly valorize our externally perceived identity, our ethnicity, our various distinctives, various aspects of our historical patrimony? How can we accept all this and value this as a constitutive element of our faith, something that we cannot and should not simply discard? But at the same time, how can we relativize our ethnicity, our distinctives, all those historically contingent aspects of our identity in response to the more compelling demands of our faith? This is a question that I hope we can explore in discussion, but then also continue on Saturday evening. And you wanted to ask some questions.
So, yes.
I'm having a ball because I'm retired and I don't depend on any of them for my livelihood.
Yep.
For studying, but also studying and interacting, I try not to create a whole lot of waves. But I can tell you, I've joked, the 4 places I serve most frequently, there are 4 jurisdictions, 4 bishops and so on, one of the churches has doors and curtains, one has curtains, no doors, one has doors, no curtains, and one has neither nor. And the way in which services are done also varies considerably. One, for example,
unchanging tradition.
For example, one very observantly sings all the prescribed troparia on the Beatitudes, all of Psalm 33:34, at blessed be the name of the Lord henceforth and forevermore, with the expectation the priest will consume the gifts at that point. The most rubricatious place I've ever seen, and consulting so closely with every little detail. And the personnel, the number of people, and so on. Fortunately, the singers are very good. At the same time, there are just enormous gaps that make things, you know, you never, the sight lines in the altar area are very poor. And I have to be going sort of like this to get someone to hand me a censer at various points. In other places, the jurisdictional differences do make it cause some complications. Directives in one will say specifically point at the paten, the chalice, at the words of institution. Another will say, no, you are not supposed to do that. And differences in sensing and so on. The biggest difficulty, though, is how to proclaim the word of God in these very different communities. Say something, because I don't have contact with all of them so regularly that I can, you know, that I know everybody, and I have terrible problems with names. How do you convey the gospel in these very different situations? How do you give hope to a parish? I'm the closest in Bisbee, Arizona. It's a mining community. The mines went out in the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. I serve there once or twice a month. I'm the closest to a full-time priest they've had since the 1970s. How in this situation do you bring a message of hope? And suggest that orthodoxy may have something to say that the local community church hasn't been telling you on all those other Sundays that you have been going to church, but maybe hearing something a little different anyway. How do you talk to a very energetic, active, and enthusiastic college-age constituency at St. Demetrius Greek Orthodox Church and Holy Resurrection Antiochian Orthodox Church in Tucson, with kids with all the usual problems of being 16, 17, 18, through the early 20s, very close group, a very wonderful group. How do you get them to appreciate and feel appreciated for their performance with the Panathenian dance troupe, but at the same time, encourage them to become more deeply involved with their faith, or simply to, and how do you allow them space to feel comfortable asking questions on religious matters? This in a situation where I'm, as you were mentioning, only just relatively recently ordained by Orthodox standards. Very recently indeed. So I can sometimes speak, I don't always speak ex cathedra and being an authority figure, especially not with these kids. But on the other hand, very often they're accustomed to that, and in Arizona, there is a very strong presence of a certain type of monasticism that can be very cultish. So you run into a huge range of issues, and I haven't sorted them all out, but it's very exciting. Now, my biggest challenge, though, and my biggest problem, you will think very trivial indeed. You were introducing me and mentioned some things that I've done, but you didn't mention the fact that my wife and I have edited 6 volumes of Orthodox liturgical music in English language, and my real love is liturgical music. And one of the churches sings very well, but my little church in Bisbee, if it weren't for my wife, I would be desperate. But we are beginning to sing quite well, and they are even able to sing Bartnyansky No. 5 cherubic hymn many times. So if you're interested in seeing what a small little Serbian Orthodox parish in a practically deserted mining town is like, go to www.ststephennemanja.org. And we even have an MP3 singing my adaptation of Serbian chant Troparion for St. Stephen Nemanja. The first question about unity, it's a question that often arises because a big concern several decades ago was especially jurisdictional unity. It seems to me we are farther from that now, even with an assembly of bishops in Canada, an assembly of bishops, Orthodox bishops in the United States. We are, for reasons related to sociology, but also old world entanglements, farther from jurisdictional unity. We very often fail to recognize those elements of unity that we do have, and we don't always feel very comfortable talking about the elements of unity that we do have. I think that the agencies or those areas in which effective Orthodox unity is developing and expressing itself in creative fashion is through, for example, OCMC, Orthodox Christian Mission Center, through IOCC, International Orthodox Christian Charities, and other forms of organization and expression quite different from anything that the Church has known through most of its history. And these are means available to us today. That was the easier question, though. I hope I'm answering part of it, at least. The question of culture, and I think you've touched on a very important subject. I think historically, and I think a correct theological perspective, emphasizes the importance of seeking out and trying to see the image of God in each and every one, and being able to find in those elements of cultures, past and present, to be able to see those things that God loves and hopes that we will love and embrace, and that we will be able somehow to communicate with. But one difficulty in our North American context, though not exclusively here, it's just where I live and how I live, is the growing tendency, if something is new and different, or if there is not any possibility of direct communication, we are so quick to heroize or to demonize, and there is no other path. We use all kinds of superlatives that would best be reserved to Christ and the Theotokos for our particular hero of the day or moment, whether in politics or in ecclesiastical matters, and language that I wouldn't use for anybody at all, the Internet contributes to this, for those with whom we disagree. This sharpening of this tendency to heroize and to demonize, and in this way to depersonalize those with whom we are interacting, I think is one of the most dangerous things in our North American society today. Again, this is, I think, rather different than the situation in our countries, three or four decades ago, where there was a greater sense of community and commonality. But this also, I think, bleeds over into church life. We become accustomed to a certain way of interacting.
Do you want to follow up on that at all?
He offers an excellent example. Another area, though, I think that's important. We so often think of mission we projected this onto antiquity, and we tend to look at mission as, if I can put it this way, an elite group of white guys goes and proclaims the gospel in various places. In the early church, what is missed, but you can find it in the New Testament, you just don't find it, you know, emphasized particularly. It's very often displaced persons. It's persons in in some cases, upper class, in more cases, the people who were not the elites of society. They were people who may be rich or well off, but not socially acceptable because they were new immigrants. The martyrs of Lyon and Vienne, for example, in Gaul, included a physician and various others who were occupied important niche roles in society. But they were a Greek-speaking ghetto in a Latin-speaking part of the empire. I think that, it's so easy to neglect the role that such people played, but still play. I was able to spend some time in Tanzania in the spring of 2008, teaching in the Little Orthodox Seminary at Kisikizi, which is about a day's walk or a four-hour drive from Bukoba on Lake Victoria. Orthodoxy in Africa is interesting because it was not a top-down white guys coming from outside and proclaiming the gospel. Christianity in Orthodox Christianity, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, grows by gossiping the gospel. It was very often just ordinary people here, because people talk about religion and things that are in fact important to them, to other people. One of the people most important for development of Orthodoxy in Tanzania had been working in an office, and one of the other people working in the office happened to be Greek, and he in this way discovered Orthodoxy. In many ways, especially in Kenya, the next over, Orthodox began not as canonical Orthodoxy with someone coming from Alexandria or from any other place. It came from movement originally in the United States of African Orthodox, Marcus Garvey and other people of this sort, to South Africa, then to elsewhere in Africa, reading their way into Orthodoxy and sort of partly inventing it as they went along, partly discovering it. And this, I think, is what gives it its vitality. That and the singing. The singing is marvelous.
We had that movement in Cape Breton, in Canada. We had a little piece of that movement. If I can ask you one thing, you talked about, you were making a case, or you were suggesting, that we're farther away from unity, even though there's more sort of jurisdictional relationship. I mean, when we think of the end of the wall came down in 89, and a number of the jurisdictions of North America, the schism, largely over issues related to the communist period, and some of that's been healed. Are you suggesting that we now live in a period where there is a more kind of virulent ideological commitment, which is different within parishes, and that is that
not partly within parishes, or just or in that virtual world of the internet, because in fact the schisms, the divisions caused or centering on communism in Eastern Europe, these are pretty much over with. And now the ideological cleavages are revealed to be within Orthodoxy itself. Or rather, they've morphed. Because in some cases they are related to people in the old world rediscovering Orthodoxy, in the same way that people here may rediscover Orthodoxy, getting little bits and snippets of it. You know, it's interesting that some of the same pathologies that you find in certain quarters in the United States, you can find in Orthodoxy in old world contexts. For example, the controversies concerning barcoding and the mark of the beast, that having a something barcoded on you, the stories of pious monks rejecting any gifts and anything that has barcoding on it because it will ensnare you with the devil.
I ran into this in Romania.
But you know, you find exactly the same ways of identifying the Antichrist and so on sites called biblicalprophecy.org and so on the internet from sects in the United States.
I believe we're going to have coffee downstairs. You're going to speak more to this matter on after Vespers on Saturday.
And I'm going to try to offer some answer to the question that I posed at the end.